Every spring is a spring.
In the house.
At precisely 22 past 2, Larry's wristwatch alarm began to yelp petulantly. It sounded like a noise that a race of hyperkinetic aliens would make en masse just before attempting to vaporize Iowa.
Didn't sound like aliens at all. It sounded like an alarm.
Oh.
Don't we have something better? Here, why not this?
I am Locutus.
All right.
Of Borg.
Oh.
It was vaporized, vaporizing Iowa.
I see. In other words, it was a sound that Larry couldn't ignore. However, he might have to ignore it for the reason that he couldn't locate the alarm button, because he likewise couldn't locate the wristwatch that housed it, or even the wrist on which it was presumably strapped. All consequences of his malfunctioning LTMLDRB, or Long-Term Memory Loss Data Retrieval Buffer.
But?
Long-term...
That's a very appealing acronym.
Thank you. He probed his memory bank. Blah,
See, that's what happens when you have long acronyms.
He probed his memory banks for details, a task that typically resulted in a string of NSF error messages. But this time, happily, he did recall why he'd set the alarm, so he would leave the house in time for the appointment he'd made exactly 1 year ago. With whom and for what purpose? Well, he'd worry about the questions to those answers later. Larry lived leagues. Larry lived 10 leagues.
Ten leagues
from his nearest neighbor.
How long is a league? Am I supposed to what in a league?
You should know.
But I have LTMLDRB.
But this was a short-term memory quiz.
Okay.
Larry lived 10 leagues from his nearest neighbor and 21 leagues from town, so leaving the house typically involved his car, which suited him just fine, since the vehicle was his pride and joy. He pressed the rewind button on his VCR remote control to activate the garage door opener. Inside the climate-controlled chamber, safe from the elements... especially bismuth and protactinium, which always seemed to have it in for Ford Motor Company products, sat a handsome 1962 Thunderbird hardtack. The car had been born and bred in Austin, Texas, and had never been driven out of state. Still, those daily commutes from Amarillo to Brownsville added up mileage-wise.
How many leagues?
Under the sea.
No, you said it was leagues. We're talking leagues. How many leagues is it from Amarillo to Brownsville? You didn't do your research.
312.
I don't believe you. All right.
Somewhere like
Continue.
That.
Continue. Yes.
Yeah. Those daily commutes from Amarillo to Brownsville added up mileage-wise.
League-wise.
Yeah. And its odometer had long since passed the one light year mark. Larry had had other classic cars... a 1944 Sphagnum Interloper, a 1950 Hudson Wingback, and a 1968 Chevrolet De Capistrano with roof-mounted pigeon coat. But the Thunderbird was his favorite. One of only 200 that had been painted Shirley Temple Black, the sleek car featured a 3.14159-liter of Coke engine with cruise-o-matic transmission Viejo, wiretap wheels, an Algonquin simulated carburetor, and a combination inflatable steering wheel and rudder. He couldn't help but stare at it proudly before opening the driver's side door. Occasionally, the car gaped back, which might nonplus another person, but Larry wasn't another person. Oft-times, he wasn't even himself. But today, he was Larry. And Larry had an important appointment in... He checked his wristwatch, was delighted to at least find his wrist... then recalled that he'd shoved the timepiece under the living room sofa cushion so he wouldn't have to listen to its annoying alarm, which he had forgotten how to deactivate. And he couldn't rely on the Thunderbird's clock, because it had been running backwards ever since the car's odometer passed the one light-year mark. Anyway, he was certain that the rendezvous was imminent.
So certain as I am just waiting for the end of this.
Yeah. So he ducked under the lintel... slithered onto the cockpit
under the
seat.
Lentils.
Under the lintel.
A lintel.
The lintel.
That's an architectural design feature.
Exactly right.
It sounds like it should be an instrument of some kind.
It's part of the car, you understand.
Oh, yes, I see now.
Ah, slithered onto the cockpit seat, latched the door, and started the T-Bird's engine. After the usual sequence of backfiring, which never failed to chase the two squatters out of the garage, it thrummed to life. Such puissance, marveled Larry, as the car bucked like a nearsighted bronco in a cactus factory. But that was fine with him. His car wasn't meant to idle. It was meant to move. He fiddled with the turn signals, which really did turn the car, first incrementally to the left, then upside down. Once the vehicle was again correctly oriented, at least for Texas thoroughfares, Larry neutralized the positronic parking brake and shifted into first gear. Out of the garage, the Thunderbird roared like a crowd of Manhattanites cheering on the New York Limerick Guild in the annual Hot Doggerel Tournament.
Hot Doggerel! Are you going to have some of those later today?
It depends on if we have catering.
Okay. Sure.
Still unsure of his destination, Larry engaged the cruise control and allowed the onboard automatic pilots to work it out amongst themselves.
You did one of those visual puns again. You know no one will have a clue that that's spelled
crew.
C.
No, they won't have a
They'll
crew.
Have a crew that it's spelled C-L-E-W control. I mean, C-R-E-W control.
Whatever that's
okay.
spelling.
All right. Well, that's important because I have it in front of me. I can see these words. You don't think our radio audience can see these words?
Sure they do. If they're online, they can go right to, where is it? It's posted there somewhere.
Yes, at calvos.org in the new shows. Yeah. Well, start that sentence again so people have some idea of this lovely visual pun.
Still unsure of his destination, Larry engaged the cruise control and allowed the onboard automatic pilots to work it out amongst themselves. To blot out the buzz of the automatonic bickering. Let's do that again.
Sure.
2, 3, 2, 1. To blot out the buzz of the automatonic bickering, he switched on the radio. Nothing happened. At least not in the car. Back at his house, however, the VCR was rewinding. Soon the squabbling fell into a cyclic cadence that lulled him into a state of lassitude. A state that bordered Texas on all three sides. Add to that the rhythmic clank of the pistons against the drivetrain, the omnipresent ticking of the dashboard clock counting down from 8.18 trillion, and the recurring ploink of the spark plug as it discharged excess bismuth, and the resulting repetitive sound was one that any acousto-electrician would die for. Well, what else could one expect from an ostinato?
Oh, ow! I knew the pain of the pun was coming.
The pain is good for you. Live with the pain.
I'm living through the pain.
The answer to that question is not to be found in the Thunderbird, or even in its garage, but rather in the house.
In the house.
Not Larry's house, but Calvos and Damien's house, which you are about to enter. At the door, brandishing a wristwatch whose alarm has been defused for the next 2 hours, is Calvos.
I'm certainly brandishing something. The thing I'm brandishing mostly is LTMLDRB.
It works for all of us.
Which I really wish had a nice acronymical pronunciation. Have you got one? Have you worked it out? What is it?
It's Lignip. Litmanderb.
Well, all this business about Austin and his auto.
Yeah.
Yes, then, and Austin...
There is a hook there, is there not?
There is a hook. There's also a hook to the long-term memory loss data retrieval buffer, and that's the fact that we are long-term memory data retrieving our interview with Larry Austin.
That's his fault. Why isn't he here? He is here.
He is here. He is here through the courtesy of our special time machine in an interview recorded in Boston at some sort of restaurant after a Boston Modern Orchestra Project concert in, 2002 or 3?
No, it was before, was it not?
It could have been. I'll have to look up the exact date.
Because the concert was then in a place with very steep seats or something, as I remember.
It was, yes, the B-Mops. So... And the reason we've waited this long to broadcast it is because we didn't have permission to use one of the pieces of music. And you know what? We still don't. And so we're not going to use it. And we're going to substitute something else there. But in any case, so we have invited Larry in the house with us here on Calvos and Damien by means of time travel back to Boston in years past. Yeah. So let's make our way back to...
He's still among the walking.
He's not only walking, he's still active. He's building new studio equipment down in Texas and everything. Hey, he was one of my heroes. You know, one of the first avant-garde pieces that I ever came across was his piece Square in John Cage's Notations book. And that was 1969. And he was the senior kind of person to admire back then. And now he's even more senior person to admire. As I've become a senior,
so have you.
All right, let's take our time trip back. Here is our interview with Larry Austin.
Well, did you instruct the listeners to listen to it with 8 ears?
It was announced that some accommodation would have to be made.
For the larger number of ears required. It's Calvos and Damien on the road once again. Here we are, across from Jordan Hall in Boston.
I thought it was Michael Jordan Hall, and I thought he was in Chicago. That's why I got confused.
So you took the wrong plane.
I did.
I see.
Well, so it happens.
Our guest today is Larry Austin. We've been chasing you for about 6 years for this interview, and we finally got you.
Sigh. I'm honored, and it's great.
Oh, good.
We originally... encountered your work.
Can we order?
Sure, let's order. Let's take a pause here on the show and we'll be right back. And we're back.
Seems like we just ate.
Yeah, so it does. You know, we first encountered your stuff, I think it was, 1974 or so. Actually,
before I met you, we
encountered a piece called Square.
Oh.
And we performed Square probably... I don't know, a dozen times with our own little ensemble and also with my elementary school kids when I taught school years later. Everybody loves Square.
We thought that you might expand it to hexagon and maybe octagon.
Well, it's for four players, obviously, sitting around a table. But variously done. They sit around the sides of the square. And then read the music left to right, top to bottom.
But the staves cross at 90
degree
angle.
That's right. There's a matrix of staves, and it has a difficult concept of small notes you play softly,
right,
and large notes you play loudly, and non-filled in notes you play. Natural and filled in notes, that is black notes, you play a sharp in front of them, you put a sharp in front of them. So
the elementary school kids found this absolutely transparent. They understood the notation implicitly because they were as yet did not have a fixed notion that notation should mean this when it's presented this way.
On the other hand, when I played it, I got all upset because it didn't correspond to my notation.
You were training and didn't have stems on the notes.
That's right.
Oh yeah, the lack of stems. Yes,
but we drew them in
and put sharps in there and things like that.
Yes.
I guess we did.
Do we have a recording to play?
We will. We'll play a recording right now. As a matter of fact, this is Square, music by Larry Austin.
From what year?
63.
Two recordings. And we're not going to listen to two performances. This is one performance of Larry Austin's Square from 1972 with four amateurs playing in the very first ensemble concert I had put together of new non-pop long before it would ever be called that. Larry Austin's Square, 1972, Trenton, New Jersey.
Thank you.
Square by Larry Austin. Well, let's hear. Now, that's sort of a conceptual piece in some ways. So let's sort of go back on your in your history. You started writing pretty straightforward stuff in the late 1940s.
Late 1940s. Gosh, you're going way back.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
But you sort of started making the impact later on. That's
yeah. Well, I studied with the Canadian composer Violet Archer, who had studied with Béla Bartók, actually piano with Béla Bartók, and with Hindemith at Yale. And she was a disciplinarian, which I needed, I suppose. And so it caused me to write neoclassic music with a little, some different things thrown in. So meanwhile, I was a jazz player and a legit trumpet player. And I played in the first 1 o'clock lab band at North Carolina State. So that was great on 1947.
This is sort of home territory.
I was schizophrenic. I was a jazz player and a classical composer.
But you can't do that. No, you have to be one or the other.
Well, I found out that was wrong.
Well, you have a story. You have a rather remarkable story about when you were working on... was it the piece we're going to hear today, the improvisations? Is that the one you were working on when you dropped it in another composer's mailbox?
Actually, it was a few pieces before that.
Let's hear that story.
1955. The summer of 1955, I was in a master class of Darius Milhaud, a French composer, during his year... Mills College, and then every alternate year he would be at the Paris Conservatory. So that he was there. I had always wanted to study with him because Babe Brubeck studied with him. I figured anybody who Babe Brubeck would study with would must be pretty good. The first master class, we all declared what we were going to compose. I said I'd like to compose a string quartet. Fine. The next day, I brought my first, not sketches, but fully worked out three or four pages. First three, four pages of the piece. And we each put the piece up on the piano rack for the maestro to criticize. And I did that. And he said, and at the top of the first page was a diagram of the form of the piece. A modified sonata allegro form, so forth. And the first thing he said, "What is this?" at the pointing at the diagram. I said, then I explained, "It's my diagram for how the piece will be formed and structured." And he took his pencil, I mean, this never happened to me, and he crossed out the diagram. He said, "How do you know what you're going to do until you do it?" Well, I was nonplussed, so I didn't mention structure or form anymore. But the very last day of the master class, 6 weeks later, was the day after the student composers' concert the night before. We were all very hyped up. I had had the first movement of my string quartet played. I was very happy about it. And my wife told me when we got back to the student village, I was going to the University of California at the time. She said, I went up to Mr. Mio and asked him she said, "Is Larry any good?"
Oh, the
only wives
yes.
can do that.
Yes.
And she reported that he'll go far. So that was good for me. Thank God he said that. Anyway, so here we are. We're waiting for all sorts of praise, an assessment, a critique of the concert and so forth. He says, "I don't want to see any pieces or talk about the concert. I want to hear some jazz." And he said, "Who plays jazz?" There are about eight of us. No one, of course, raised their hand, including me.
Including you?
Yes, including me. He says, "This is impossible. You're American. And no one here plays jazz." And so he went around one by one. "Do you play jazz? Do you play jazz?" "Yes, to me. Do you play jazz, Mr. Austin?" Yes, I do. Huh? Impossible. It doesn't come out in your music. And so it was a life moment for me. And that's really what led me to write, begin to write, in fact, this hybrid music, I suppose you could say. And the next few pieces, in fact, up to the piece that is being performed today by the Boston Modern Orchestra Project, Jill Rose conductor, the in 1961, I composed this piece, actually sponsored by Gunther Schuller. He asked me to compose a piece. He heard some of these earlier chamber works that involved jazz, and he said he invited me to write an orchestra piece with jazz soloists, and because he was going to be conducting and organizing the first international jazz festival in Washington, D.C. The next summer, 1961, I went to McDowell Colony and in 3 weeks had composed it. In 1 week, I orchestrated it. And, of course, you're writing all the time there, and it was a wonderful experience to have that opportunity to compose in an idyllic retreat in New Hampshire. And I drove down, or I took the bus down to New York and met with Gunther Schuller in his apartment. And he says, we'll perform it next year. So that's the story, I guess, that you're referring to.
And but you're not.
But he had coined the phrase third stream,
right?
In 1957, I believe. But before that, he was already writing pieces that involved jazz and classical music, classical contemporary music, and I had heard a few of them by that time.
You
was enthusiastic.
You didn't always get such a welcome, though. At one point, you mentioned to us that you were expected in some way to declare what camp you were part of.
Oh, yes. Well, everyone in the late 50s and into the 60s, and I guess it, not so much in the 70s, you were, as a student, you, of course, aligned yourself with a particular teacher who was in a particular camp, either Schoenberg or Stravinsky. Later on, it was either Babbitt or Cage, for that matter. You couldn't be in one camp. You couldn't be in both camps. So I guess I like that third camp and have ever since, I presume. Though I use techniques of improvisation, certainly, and I use serial technique. Anything that worked musically, and so was in a sense a heretic to both camps, but it was certainly in those times you had to choose sides. Yes, indeed.
How did you arrive at the realm of doing electronics? That's the other side. I mean, you know, we have this sort of wide panoply of works that come from you. They come from you. We have the sort of clearly speaking from a jazz background and a performer trumpeter's background, as
that's right,
the improvisation show, and then the sort of well-schooled composer in the through-composed sort of European style, and then we have these experiments, and then later great sort of monumental works in multiple channels. How did that happen?
Not by accident, though maybe it was accident. I was in the right place at the right time. I didn't have access to an electronic music studio through these years, but was also interested in free group improvisation in the early 60s, probably more so than in electronic. But I had the opportunity on a sabbatical in Rome, 1964-65, to have access to the American Academy in Rome's fledgling electronic music studio that had been built by Bill Smith and John Eaton, and with help from Lusicheski and Luning. And it was a classical electronic music studio, that is, with banks of oscillators and stereo tape recorders, which was a big deal then, but plus mono t- t- tape recorders. So for the first time, I wanted to experiment with electronic music. But
why did you want to do that? I mean, as a person from the background, I mean, first of all, just to give people, you're from Oklahoma, you are in Texas now, and you went to the West Coast, but somehow in the process, something triggered this interest in electronics. How did that happen?
It must be the art song. Yes, went through the art song phase.
Well, I heard some electronic music. First of all. Some of those early records I had heard as a student when I was at North Texas, those early experiments. And they were crude to me, but I was fascinated because of, I thought maybe I could make my own theater music or my own something approaching orchestral music in the studio. I wasn't getting an enormous number of performances, but with orchestras. It simply fascinated me. I started experimenting with it, and I was hooked from the very beginning. It was also, I think, it stems from my love of color, controlling color, which is very much part of the jazz tradition. Great jazz players like Coleman Hawkins, for instance. It's like the horn is speaking to you, and it's through color, and it uses phonemes, and all the great players, it's certainly Miles Davis and Parker and so on. I think it came from that need for color and also the freedom that the studio offered me. I could actually improvise there, work with the materials, and they would tell me what to do. I'd create the materials there. It's like having a bunch of performers sitting in the studio with you. And so I was hooked. And meanwhile, my background as a performer and as a concert music maker made me want to combine live performance with taped electronic music. In fact, my very first piece was for improvisation ensemble and tape, and it was a theater piece. So it was staged and everything, which makes it less formidable, I suppose, for audiences. It wasn't, in fact, till some years later that I made solo tape pieces where they would simply have the two or four speakers and you'd sit there and experience the piece without performers. That seemed to me a difficult concept at first. And I think it was probably two or three years before I made a piece that didn't involve live performers. The tape piece, that is.
Well, you mentioned the theater piece, you were sort of the founder of a movement of open structure. What was the name of
Open Style?
Open Style. Open Style. That's a sort of a rundown of how that came about and why.
Well, it came about because of two things. First, that a group we formed in California called the New Music Ensemble was never used music. We made music, but we didn't use paper music. We were a group for a free group improvisation. I'd been experimenting with that since the late 50s, anyway, with jazz, combining serial techniques. Instead of using chord changes, I'd use serial techniques, and players would play these rows of notes together, and that led to free group improvisation. We freed ourselves of that and the stylistic implications that has too.
Who else was in that group?
Well, probably names you may not know, though you might. Stanley Lunetta, Sacramento, California. Well, you may know Derry John Mizell. He was in the group. Now I'm New York composer. The pizza's here.
Yes. Should we?
Yeah.
And the soup.
And the soup. So.
Yeah. Right. Let's see. Richard Swift. Billy Alexander. See, you know the names, but they were all close friends and close associates. Who in fact later, just a few years later, almost the same group came together to as partners to form the board and publishers of Source Magazine, Music of the Avant-Garde. Where am I?
Well, yeah.
Oh, you're talking
about...
OpenStyle.
Yeah, OpenStyle.
Okay. So OpenStyle was me writing notes on paper again,
right,
in an OpenStyle without metered time, though there was measured time, space notation, just as Square used black and white notes. I reinstituted stems, and in fact wrote several pieces in this style. The other reason. Since I gave two reasons. The other reason was that it was during my year in Rome. I was writing like mad, the cultural impact of Italy was enormous on me. It was the first time I had been in Europe. Great cultural impact. We think of the Italian culture as being open and free and happy and carefree. They're not. It's a very closed society with expectations for the sun, the family is a very tight group there, and there's not the freedom that I had known. So I said, well, I'm going to write pieces that are open. And in fact, one of the first pieces I composed was for Bill Smith and John Eaton called Current, and it's subtitled also Open Style for Clarinet. And it was done at the Venice Biennale in 64, Paul 64. And it slams the keyboard cover and does all sorts of things. And he does multiphonics, a multiphonic piece on the clarinet. And there was a review by an Italian. I think there were several reviews, in fact. But one of them said it was an action piece, just like Jackson Pollock throwing things around. So that pleased me. That pleased me, because he understood open style then. So that's kind of what it is. It's a free, unpretentious way of making music, though it's controlled to the extent that I do provide notes and opportunities and processes for people to play.
Let's take a break, have a little food, and we'll be back with our guest today on Calvus and Damien.
Meanwhile, we'll play something.
And we'll play something, of course.
Yes, indeed.
But
we know what it is.
We'll eat while it plays.
Yes.
Our guest is Larry Austin.
What are you going to play?
Right, we don't know.
And what we are going to hear are three sections from Blues Acts from 1995 for saxophonist and computer music and processing. It's in seven sections. We'll hear three, performed here by Stephen Duke on soprano and alto saxophones. The sections are Blues in Cameroon, Train, and Blues Out Parker, music by Larry Austin. Three sections from Blues Acts from 1995 by Larry Austin, Stephen Duke performing there, Blues in Cameroon, Train, and Blues Out Parker.